Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Moon, Moo and You, the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and Joan Adams and I host this show. Our guest this evening is Leonard Lasko, author of Healing with Love. I have read the book, I'd say, about 4 to 5 times and discover something profound each time I read it. Len was an OBGYN physician who one day realized that he was a healer. He also discovered that he was no more or less worthy to heal than anyone else. Now, this part is very important for us in the world of spiritual pursuits because we might think we are somehow superior to other people who may appear, quote, ignorant, end quote, and get into what I've always called spiritual elitism. But Leonard is not at all into that category. The call-in number this evening is 347-205-9200. So we have a lot to discuss today. Before we go much further, here is Joan Adams, a.k.a. Moonvine. Hello, Joan.
Good afternoon, Kate.
Nice to hear your voice.
It is nice to be here. Looking forward to hearing Leonard, I'll tell you.
Yeah, isn't it great?
Yeah, it's exciting.
Well, let me just bring him right on. Hello, Leonard.
Hi.
Great to hear your voice.
Yeah.
Thank you. I want to introduce you to Joan Adams. And Joan,
hi,
Leonard.
And we are delighted you're here.
Yeah, same here. I'm looking forward to what I have to say and what you folks have to say.
Well, now, did you hear my introduction about the part about being a physician, which is rather scientific and kind of, in my opinion, kind of a scary place to be, and then having what happened to you happen. So could you tell us your story a little bit?
Sure. I was in a busy practice in San Francisco, and I went to a retreat, during the retreat, I went into a meditation during the night. It may have been about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and the room was dark, and then suddenly during the meditation, spontaneously, it seemed as if someone had turned on the lights. I opened my eyes, and the room was still dark, and then here was this inner luminosity again, and then I felt a presence, and I heard a voice inside my head. And this, I say a voice, but this was really like an awesome, indescribable communication that said, your work is to heal with love. And it was so clear. I knew it was true. Tears started to roll down my cheeks. Hair stood up the back of my neck. And I silently said, oh, so I'm worthy. And this presence said, you are no more or less worthy than anyone else. Your work is to heal with love. And at that time, I did not know what that meant. That was quite a few years ago. But as I said, I knew it was true. And eventually, that truth unfolded and revealed itself in the book that you mentioned that you read a number of times called Healing with Love.
Yeah.
So that's how it kind of, that's how it all began. It took quite a while for me to, after that, to eventually sell my practice and devote myself full time to the exploration of healing and love, and to discover what love means to me, in the sense that I'm to be healing with it. Because these are such common words, healing and love. As a matter of fact, the editors, the publishers of the book, at that time Harper, San Francisco, I now publish the book under another publisher, but Harper at that time said, no, we can't use healing with love. That title is too common. It's a very New Age title. I even though they had the copyright after I got the advances and signed the contract, I said, I'm sorry, it has to be that title. And I persisted, and that eventually was the title.
It had
to be that title.
Exactly. I think you were sort of shocked when you heard that they weren't going to publish it under that title.
Yeah, I was very, very firm about that one, and I prevailed, so...
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
I think that's terrific. Because we all benefit. I think any other title would have been a little, I don't know. What other titles were you thinking of? I just can't imagine any other title.
Yeah, I don't know. They had other ideas, but this came from a much higher place than where their titles came from. So.
Right on. Well, so in that process, I imagine you were working with the love vibration with your patients before you entered into your own healing with love practice. And I would imagine that's what you taught all of us, because I must say to our listening audience that my husband Tom and I have taken, Tom especially, and I took a lot myself, but Tom took the whole course of holo energetic healing, and got certified as a holo energetic healer. And
We call him a practitioner.
Correct.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, cool. And that course is no longer available. So the people that you have taught are sort of a little flock of people on the planet, and who send out their love but I just want to say that your work is very powerful, and we use it. And when I forget to use it, I know I have forgotten to use it, and I am brought right back. My healing image, which I would like you to talk about the healing image a little bit. But my healing image is always in my mind. And I think, that must have been about 14 years ago that
yes.
we first met you. And
yes.
And so that work was, the work that I did with you was about 14 years ago, and it has really stayed with me heavily. And as you know, Tom has been transformed by it too.
Sure, sure.
So the healing image, tell us about that.
Well, I mean, that healing image is part of a larger process, which I call holo energetic healing, and holos is the Greek term for whole or entire, and so holo energetic healing is healing with the energy of the whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. And if I were to summarize, I'd say, just to put it into the healing image into context, that holoenergetic healing is a method of healing which traces illness and suffering and distress back to their experiential roots, you could say, and then releases these separative energies and perceptions and beliefs at their core, and brings us back into wholeness with ourselves, with Source, with our spiritual essence. So that's what holoenergetic healing in general is. And then there are four parts to the healing process. I call them the four R's. And one of those involves the healing image that you referred to. And just briefly, the first R, and this is for people who have illness, who are experiencing distress, who are suffering, and who want to return to their essential nature. That's essentially what this is about. So the first R is to recognize that there's something that you want to change, that there's a problem or circumstance that you want to change. And for some people, they have to wait until the dark night of the soul, until something really, really difficult and serious happens. But that precipitates change. And then you want to look at what it is that you want to change. And then you need to come into resonance with what it is that you want to change and heal. In other words, instead of denying or disowning or projecting or resisting, suppressing, you actually need to focus on the issue that you want to change, meaning that there's truth here. This is happening, and this is what is in the moment. So instead of covering it up with nice feelings and such, you just simply look at what is, because truth ultimately will set you free. So you look at what is, meaning that you come into resonance with what is. You become, in a sense, one with it, and then it reveals itself. By becoming one with it, you can go back to the experiential roots that we just mentioned, and you realize where this came from. Usually, it's a misperception, misinterpretations, or beliefs, early experiences that crystallized into beliefs that are unconscious, that are transparent, so that you don't even see that you're looking through filters at your experience, and then it attracts to it its own vibration. The law of attraction is sometimes called, and so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Your whole life supports these belief systems. I'm not okay. I'm not good enough. Are some of the basic belief systems that people have, and so. Then once you come to realize what the source of the issue is, and you see, I don't do this for someone. The practitioner doesn't do this for someone. You have your own insights, so you're operating from the seat of your power, and that's a beautiful part of this process. You know, in a sense, you created it, and you can discreate it, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to realize that whatever this was that veiled you from your essential nature, whatever this these veils are, underneath these veils is your essential nature expressing itself through your soul as certain feeling states that your soul wants to experience at that time in your life, at this time in your life too.
Mm-hmm.
And so each person's soul is like an individual fingerprint that's different from every other soul and yet, of course, has things in common. So these feelings now that you've always wanted to experience, and usually some of them include feelings like safety, feelings like love, connectedness, belonging, feelings like joy, peace, a sense of unity or harmony, abundance, a sense of self-empowerment, a sense of creativity, a desire for pleasure, giving and receiving. So these are some of the qualities that your soul wants to express and experience. And you get in touch with that in a specific process, and you ask that something come forth that symbolizes or represents or is an image of a group of four or five of these feelings. And that's how the healing image comes about. You don't create it with your mind. You actually empty your mind and allow the intuitive part of your mind to spontaneously bring this forth, because it already exists in the morphic field for you. And then it comes in, and this becomes your representation of a healing force within you that will take the place of this holiform of illness or suffering or distress. You literally release it after you understand it, and you replace it with the healing image. And so that creates the reformation, because the four R's are recognize, resonate, release energetically what no longer serves you. At one time, it may have protected you in one way or another. And then finally, you reform the form with the healing image in alignment with your essential nature. And that's sort of a quick summary of the process, which we call the tracing process.
Mm-hmm. And it is truly transformational because, like I say, you know, we've been carrying this with us for 14 years, and it's not something that we did once and don't do it anymore, don't think about it, or don't discuss, or you know what I mean. And
sure.
Another thing that is very important in the process is forgiveness.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, people have different conceptions of what forgiveness is about, and then there's a dictionary definition that sometimes involves forgetting, and a lot of people are very reluctant to forgive if it means forgetting, because then they may be doomed to repeat the perpetuation of this, whatever the actions were. But that's not my definition of forgiveness, because forgiving, although it seems generally that you're forgiving another person, where does all this forgiveness take place when you're forgiving? It's
yourself.
Really taking place within you, yes. So actually forgiveness is really truly an inside job. And when you're forgiving somebody else, what you're really doing is you're giving yourself love and freedom. So forgiving is forgiving yourself this love and this freedom by releasing the attachments and the charge associated with whatever the circumstances were, releasing your identification with the story so
mm-hmm.
that you're not attached to the past, because you become, through continued anger and judgment and blame, you become a prisoner of the past. And you, in a sense, are in jail with the person that you're wanting to punish through your continued anger that you're holding on to and your judgment. So forgiving really is giving yourself love and freedom. But the most important person to forgive is not the other person, but yourself. So that's the deepest part of forgiving. In other words, forgiving yourself for all the things that you may have done or that you didn't do that were not loving to yourself or others, things that you felt ashamed of, that you felt guilty about, things that you felt remorse regarding. It's time to release that. It's time
mm-hmm.
to start giving that up and starting to love yourself. And so that's the deepest part of, and we have a process called the forgiveness process. It only takes about 20 or 30 minutes, and it's very, very profound, and it's done as an internal dialogue so that you don't share out loud who it is that you're forgiving and what the circumstances were, so you don't get involved with the story in the sense that you just wallow in the energy for a long time. But it is
mm-hmm.
important that you bring up the feelings as you communicate them silently to the other person, and especially to the three aspects of yourself, little one and the adolescent, teenager, and the adult. So
mm-hmm.
you communicate that, and then all of this is sealed by calling forth your essential nature and asking for forgiveness, essentially from grace, as it were, because that's where the ultimate source of forgiveness and healing really comes from.
Yes, when you're in that midst of not forgiving, and you, as you say, you're in a prison, it's almost, and you acted, what you said there was like you're in prison with this entity that is resentful and hateful. And it's almost like being in prison with your evil twin, because it is you as you don't want to really be.
That's right.
And then by doing the forgiveness process and coming into oneness with Source, you get rid of that other hateful thing.
That's right. That's a part of yourself that's very unhealthy, and that is causing blockages within you of energy flow, and of course that can result in illness. That can result in a lot of suffering and distress. And so ultimately, the key is to release your identification with the mind-made self and its belief systems, with the thoughts and the feelings and the sensations that you normally identify with as if that was you. So the higher level of healing is healing into wholeness.
Yes.
Love. And now, this is the newer work that I'm involved with. But, it's the spiritual aspect of healing beyond, but beyond means it includes, in other words, it includes healing of the physical, emotional, and mental bodies, but it transcends those, so that's important.
Yeah. Now, I know we've been talking about healing on a personal level here, but what about the resentments that go back generations between, neighboring countries and, say, Israel and the Palestinians and even during the Civil War between the North and the South, which these sorts of things are carried forth, into the subliminal psyche, as it were. And I'm just curious, I know you and I have talked about it in the past, about how those things are healed between these neighboring countries or even between, just general different people who perceive themselves to be different, when in reality they're not.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word different, because one thing that I began to realize in exploring this whole human dilemma here, because of, for thousands and thousands of years, people have been fighting one another and fighting over territory and fighting over food and so on and so forth. And people see that they're different from one another in some respects, and they misinterpret difference for separation.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there can be difference without separation, in the same way that the leaves on a tree may be different from one another, but they're not separate from the tree.
Oh, that's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And so when we misinterpret difference for separation, then we feel that we can do anything that we want to another, not realizing that what we do to another, we do to ourselves. And that's why the golden rule is so beautiful: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Because, in fact, there is only one appearing as many, revealing itself as love. And when we recognize that, and that's the newer work that I'm doing, that's what I call healing into wholeness, recognizing that there is only one appearing as many. And as you do to another, so you do to yourself. And that was a brilliant, brilliant teaching of Christ. And so this is what I've come to realize over the years, and also, of course, I started to explore that in the laboratory, working with cancer cells and seeing if my sense of what love is really applies even to single-celled organisms.
Mm-hmm.
Because what love really involves is this recognition of oneness on one level. There's an awareness of oneness. Then there's, on another level, a felt sense of oneness on an emotional level. And then on a physical level, there's frequently a desire to embrace or merge with the object of your love, like in a simple thing like a food, that you love this chocolate ice cream or vanilla or strawberry. Different. Now, each of these flavors are different, you know. That's a personal taste. But you want to merge with it. If you love this ice cream, you eat it. You become one with it. And so on a spiritual level, when you become aware of that oneness, you then merge with it, and even love dissolves into oneness. Then there is no other.
Mm-hmm.
See, Christ said, whenever two or more meet in my name, I will be there. Well, he really, at that time, was referring to the two appearing to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the presence of love, they merge and become one. So,
yes, and then there's the mystics who, like Sri Ramakrishna, who and many others in India who continuously commune with the divine in an almost a mystical ecstatic state.
Right, and
so
then, of course, the deep realization is that there is no other. There is no divine. The divine
right.
is within, is without, is everywhere, is you and is me. Despite the appearance of separation and other, you know, and this appearance of separation is based on the perceptions of the mind, which are designed that way, not because the mind is somehow bad or wrong.
Right.
The mind is designed to filter out the overwhelming amount of stimuli that come in and just seek pattern recognition of what it considers to be important, what it's been programmed to consider important. And the senses are just extensions of the mind, and they too filter out vast amounts of information. You have a limited range of viewing of visible light that you can see, and a visible range of sound that you can hear, smells that you can smell, touch that you can taste. Everything is limited within certain ranges so that the mind can continue to function. And all this information that pours in has to be put in little cubby holes, and then beliefs are formed, and then you perceive through these beliefs that are further filters, and then you identify with the thoughts and the feelings and the senses that arise from the mind-body. And you think you create a sense that this is an I-me, and that
mm-hmm.
is independent and separate from everything else. And that's the way the mind is designed to function. But as you expand and beyond the misidentification with yourself as just a body-mind, you come to realize the unity of everything. And that's healing into wholeness. That I was just referring to is the more recent work that I've been doing. Because, you know, after all, if you identify with the body, this body is here temporarily. It may be
mm-hmm.
around for 70 years, 100 years, 120 years. People want to extend your life. So what? You know, it's sooner or later, it'll return to stardust. But, you know,
I
well,
like
it came from stardust, and it's going to return
yeah.
to stardust.
Of course.
And, you know, but if you come to realize that aspect of being that was never born, you know, and will never die, it just assumes a body that is born and will die, then you achieve... if you were to put a label on it, eternity, immortality, of course these things don't mean anything from that perspective at all. I mean, they have no meaning at all because there's no time with regard to that being. But that's the deepest work of healing. That's healing and wholeness come from the same root. You know, so true healing is healing into wholeness, into oneness, the recognition, the realization of that. And when I started doing healing work with cancer, I came to realize, as I was focusing on the cells, that they had, you know, the same right to exist as I did, but from the human perspective, you know, I had an attitude toward them that created a lot of resistance on their part. But when you just accept the truth of their existence, because at the moment they are existing and that's what they want, but they've lost their way. And if you accept them just as they are in the moment, your awareness begins to vibrate at the same frequency that they're vibrating at, because everything that exists, including thoughts, feelings, and sense perceptions, exist as vibration. And so that's true for the cancer cells. They have their unique combination of vibrations. And when your awareness, without a filter to distort it, begins to vibrate at the same frequency, you become one with whatever it is you're focusing on, if it happens to be the cancer cell or a bacteria. And when you become one with them, then the two become one like two tuning forks of the same frequency, vibrating together. Then whatever input, whatever intention you have, whatever information and energy you have in that state of unity has a maximal impact, and you can change the growth rate of these cancer cells doing that. And of course, I'm saying this because that's what I've done in the laboratory, and then I've taught people how to do this themselves. And then I started to realize what it meant to heal with love. You heal out of a sense of oneness and unity rather than attacking or resisting and destroying something. So there are many ways to effect change. I mean, I was a surgeon, and I would operate on tumors and cut them out, and sometimes that's what's needed. And, of course, chemotherapy and radiation, some of the variety of tools that modern medicine has and can be very valid ways of approaching this. And there are also these other ways that operate on many dimensions simultaneously, not only the physical and energetic dimensions. And so that's what I've been exploring, you know, over the years, and what's in my book, Healing with Love, and a lot of information on my website as well about that.
Yes, and your website is www.lasko.net.
Yeah, LASKOW, because people don't know how to spell it necessarily. So LASKOW.net, yeah.
And as we had discussed earlier today, we want people to know that you plan to come to the East Coast the first one or two of the first 2 weeks of August. And if they are interested in knowing where you will be, it would be so great if they would go to your website and sign up to
be on the mailing list, and we would let them know when we'll be there. And
where.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yes, we're going to have fun for sure. But you know, a lot of people are interested in this cancer cell thing, and you know, people are terrified of cancer, and I would imagine that when you receive such a diagnosis, it's impossible to, especially at first, to get a handle on what to do about it, you know? And you would see this cancer as being totally separate, as an alien force that's out to get you, something that is an enemy. And what you're describing is something completely different. You know, love sees no enemies. And, you know, you're talking about the work of Jesus a few times here, Christ, the Christ consciousness. My aunt was a bishop's wife, a bishop of the Episcopalian Church. And we would do a lot of the holo-energetic healing with her. And as you know, a lot of people are not necessarily in tune with the work. But she would receive the work, and after a while she looked at us and said, you know, this work is in line with what Jesus taught. And I just wanted to throw that out there because I think that is so important, that love is what was the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that was where he or the Christ consciousness, what it is. So and so, and when you talk about, go ahead, Joan.
I was just going to say yes, and we missed the message. You know,
mm-hmm.
we took the message of love and we've twisted it all around until it's something else. And so I think now I'm watching people come back to just the center of love, period, and not trying to, there's no further theology needed. Love is love and God is love and that's it. And more I see that happening.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the term love has been misused and abused and misunderstood in the same way that the term God has been abused and misused, you know, in the Spanish Inquisition, why people were tortured in the name of God, and suicide bombers, kill many people supposedly in the name of Allah, etc. And a lot of people have been abused in the name of love, so-called. You know, I love you, therefore you do this for me and do that for me. Most of what we term love is not what I would call love, the definition that I would give it and what I've referred to before. I mean, many people say, I give to you so that you can give to me. And let's call that love. And but it's not because people are bad or wrong. You know, it's part of the human condition. It takes your 9 months to finally come out of the womb. And when you do, as a little baby, you're totally helpless and dependent on your caregiver. In contrast to a giraffe, say, that's born in the in Africa and within moments has to stand up, or a horse has to stand up and then run with the herd, or else it'll be food for the lion, you know. And so we, on the other hand, are so helpless that as babies we learn right away that when our needs are not being met, we have to cry and or smile, or somehow get the attention of our caregiver, and realize that our survival depends on this attention, this nurturing, or you could say this love. So as part of the human condition, we learn that we have to do what others seem to want from us, whether it's a giggle or, you know, looking directly into somebody's eyes or something. Then we get fed, we get cared for, and so on. And eventually we have to learn to care for and give to ourselves the very love that we're wanting from others. But most of our training is to find out what others want and need so that they can give us the love that we are seeking within. And as long as we're seeking it, then we don't find it within ourselves, because we're running like a dog chasing its tail. You know, we don't realize that we ourselves are the source of the love that we're seeking outside of ourselves. Once we discover that, of course, we come to a sense of deep peace and freedom. And then we have something to give, not so that there's something in return that we're giving that for, but just to give it like a flower releases its fragrance and like the sun releases its light, and to shine on everyone equally, you know, that from the perspective of the sun, no one is more or less worthy than anyone else from the perspective of the flower. No one is more or less worthy to receive its fragrance than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ultimately true of the highest forms of love as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that transforms people when they receive this unconditioned love. And most people have not experienced that in their lifetime. They've never experienced unconditioned love. It's just a concept to them. But one of the things that we do, and I know that you know this, Kate, is that at the end of each of the processes that we talked about, for example, the tracing process and the forgiveness process, they end with the unconditioned love process.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe for the first time in people's lives, they can directly experience what it feels like to be unconditionally loved by Source.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. That's really works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that's what ultimately seals the healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by linking it through love to unity. Because, you know, ultimately, as we were talking about, what love really links the physical with the inner energy body and the inner energy body with our spiritual essence. So it links, you know, matter and energy and spirit, because they're all part of a continuum. And so that's what love does. Love is really the link between, the appearance of between. It links the appearance of between in such a way that it takes you beyond the appearance of separation into unity. And so that's really what love does. And what I had to do, and we keep coming back to this, is I had to take this beyond the conceptual. I had to go into a number of university laboratories and work with bacteria and cancer cells, with DNA and with water, and just see if love has an impact on living and non-living systems in such a way that it affects their growth rate, in such a way that we can actually define it. And we were able to do that. We were able to see what the impact was on DNA and radioactive thymidine and optical density of the growth rate of bacteria through, interestingly enough, not attacking it, but through focusing with a loving acceptance on any of these living organisms and on water itself, and seeing what the impact is.
Oh,
which is why prayer works.
Yeah, and another way of talking about prayer. Prayer is kind of can be a little narrow in terms of its definition. When people hear prayer, they think of, certain religions that use prayer and so on. But really, we're talking about intention, focused intention in alignment with something higher than your own mental capability. Although some people think it's only them and their mind that creates what they want. And in a limited sense, the mind does create what it does impact the world, but the mind doesn't function in isolation, although it may think it does, and everything is interconnected with everything else. So when the thoughts come into the mind, where do the thoughts come from, since everything is interconnected with everything else? And where does the so-called effect come from? You see, you think, oh, the thought that I have in my mind and what I hold has an effect, and therefore I was the first cause. And that's kind of laughable when you really go deeper and higher. But, at some point in people's evolution, they learn more about what the truth is.
Yes. Right,
but you have a patient in a hospital bed who is surrounded by a loving family, who is sending loving thoughts, then you see a change.
That's
in
right.
That patient.
That's it. That field
Right.
Now, that loving field is what really helps to make a shift. It creates it's like a catalyst. It's like I sometimes liken it to the field created by a magnetic resonant imaging, the so-called MRI, which creates a strong magnetic field and then puts a radio frequency into that field, and that radio frequency can then read a variety of images. After all the hydrogen protons are lined up, and then a frequency that's in resonance with those protons is pulsed in, and then depending on the concentration of hydrogen ions, there's a release of that energy, and it can be read and interpreted. And in the same way, love creates a field, and when you put in an intention in that field, it has a profound impact in a way that if it's that same intention is put in, but it's not in a loving field, doesn't have the impact. So that loving intention is so critical to the healing process, and that plus a willingness on the part of the person to be healed plus grace results in healing. You know, that's one way. And the body, of course, also knows how to heal. It heals naturally. We all know that in medicine. And certainly I, as a surgeon, knew that I didn't do the healing. I may have done something. I may have operated, so on. But that person's own natural healing, inherent healing abilities, what created the ultimate healing for that person on a physical level. So the body knows how to heal. We have to remove the blocks to that. And there can be emotional blockages. There can be mental blockages at the level of belief. And there, of course, there are physical issues that we have to and energetic issues that we have to address as well that create these blockages.
Well,
so there are all these. Yeah, go ahead.
That in the chat room, there's a question that I believe you just answered, but I'll say it. Do you believe if I believe my body will heal itself, that I will heal myself? You were talking about the healing power that goes beyond the body and is in other physical, non-physical realms, and I think you just answered that. But then this other question is, a psychic told him or her that I have a gift of healing, but I don't know how to use it. And I think that is a beautiful, a question. I mean, how would you address that?
Well, I think everyone has an inherent ability to heal themselves and to heal others. But some are more talented, they're gifted naturally than others.
Mm-hmm.
And just like some people can play musical instruments so easily, and then there are others who have to work at it. But what I've found is that even if you're not like a naturally gifted healer, if you feel the impulse to heal and you work at it, you can become a very powerful and effective healer. But then when we use the word healer, it sounds like we're doing the healing. Ultimately, you have to realize that the healing does not come from you. It comes through you and through the other person, and ultimately it's a gift of grace. In other words, when you do whatever you're doing, you have to release attachment to the outcome. Otherwise, you're giving your ego a lot of inflationary strokes, and then you're no longer functioning as a conduit. You're functioning as an ego, meaning that you're strengthening the perception of separation, because that's essentially what the function of the ego is, to continue its seemingly independent existence in a separative way, feeling that it's either better than or less than. It's the imaginary self that's constructed of identifying with itself as its body, and its thoughts and its feelings and its sensations and its beliefs. And so eventually, even though there may be some initial successes, eventually it will collapse, just like a balloon that's been deflated, because it focuses on outcomes as if its life is dependent on the outcome of its attention. So it's very important to address, you know, why does somebody want to work with others and heal others, quote unquote? You know, what's the motivation behind it? Why do it at all? And what difference will it really make in the larger sense of things? You know, so you really look at it and you say, well, if it just helps people and they feel better, that's wonderful. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But
it's not always going to happen.
That's right. It won't, because for a variety of reasons, one of which is that every person has every person's soul has an agenda that you may not be privy to. You know, they have a blueprint, and you think, oh, somebody's ill. They should always try to get better, or try to. We should always try to heal everybody, you know, so that they overcome their illness. And that's not necessarily true. That's what I mean by not being attached to the outcome. We may not know what that person's agenda is, so we do whatever we're inclined to do or impelled to do, and then we let it go. And then if it happens, it happens. Because your interaction with that person is supposed to have created some seeming effect, and so you do that.
You know,
a person who is interested in exploring healing needs to explore it from that perspective beyond, you know, the ego. Oh, that'll make me a better person if I can do that.
More valuable
person. You're totally valued just as you are as a being. And you know, your doing this is not going to make you a better person. Your accumulation of money in a bank is not going to make you a better person.
That's right.
So you can't. You know, you don't do it for that reason.
I was going to say, you know, I know for a fact that when we come into this world, that we really are nothing but love. And I see it with the newborn babies, because I'm a labor and delivery nurse. I see these babies coming out into the world, and as you were an OBGYN, probably delivered a lot of babies, seeing that amazing, oh my God, they look at you with absolute lack of separation, as you say, just no limitations.
Exactly,
and,
there's just oneness there.
And it's because they haven't been taught to, you know, differentiate between this word, that word, and haven't been told to obey the authorities, and, you know, they aren't taught any rules. And at that moment, it's all totally expanded. And looking into that face and that the face of that newborn baby is one of the most profound experiences.
Well, that's one of the reasons I went into OB was because almost every other aspect of medicine deals with pathology, and this deals with new life. And you know, while most of our learning in OBGYN is about pathology, the bottom line is when you do most deliveries and they're normal deliveries. You know, there's just so much joy and happiness with the new life, and it's an incredible experience to stand before, and that's what obstetric means, is to stand before, and that's what the word means.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and to stand before new life is such a joy and such an honor. And then, as you know, when you make rounds on the OB floors, it's, oh, doctor, you know, nurse, look at blah, 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 look at this little. And, you know, before it has a name, it doesn't matter what its name is, it's just this incredible creation of the divine, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, and before it starts
probably,
to be conditioned.
Yeah, it's probably better not to even name that little one at all for a while, just for the very reasons that we're saying. I mean, not to give any limitation to that little newborn baby at all.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. Since we're talking about names, I spoke to a Russian OBGYN who practices in Moscow, and he says the in his hospital and a number of others in Russia, what they do is they play different notes to the baby while it's in utero, and when the notes come into resonance with the baby, that baby starts to move. So they develop a series of tones, and then they create a song, and the mother sings that song to the baby. And when the baby is named, it's named in terms of using the various resonances associated with the name, so that the baby's name really resonates with the baby.
Wow.
With the tone, with that tone that they
with
had
those tones, with those tones.
Wow.
Because when the mother speaks those tones to the baby moves. It responds. It doesn't respond to another name, but it responds to that name with those tones.
Well, you know, the music that you heard before the program, interestingly enough, that music was created for women who were in preterm labor. So that when they listen to this music, it's so calming and so relaxing. And for the majority of it, actually was composed by two men from Denmark. And what happens is that they are in such a relaxed state. They don't watch TV. They don't read trashy novels. They listen to this music. And it, for some reason, of course, we can imagine what that reason would be, they don't go into the preterm labor less and on those units that listen to the music than on the units where people are just kind of chaotic, watching bad TV, you know, just, you know, having dramas in the room and everybody's in a state of total excitement.
Sure, sure.
The music totally calms it down.
Oh,
and that's why and that's why it was composed.
Right.
So that's
a holiness
fascinating.
In it. Yes,
beautiful.
There's definitely
a
holiness to it, and I don't understand it. I don't even know if we have words for it, but it's back to the tones you were discussing. I think
exactly
this music has a holiness about it.
Yes,
that is beyond our vocabulary.
And the baby hears the little baby in the uterus.
Yes.
You know,
and then when you look at some music that seems to really be in great favor, even with indigenous peoples like, say, in the Amazon who've never heard, they like Mozart and they like even Bach. And when you listen to the music, you see that they have these points and counterpoints. They have in the background, they have the music that essentially represents the mother's heart, which is slower, you know. And then you have the baby's heartbeat, which is twice as fast as da 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 da. And that's what the baby hears. That's what we hear in utero. If you know, people have done work with putting sound sensors up against the uterus or even inside the uterus to hear what the baby hears. And we're attracted to that kind of music that has both the mother sound and one's own heartbeat. And so that's the music that we relate to, that's very primal in a sense.
Oh, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we only have two seconds left on the program. That's hysterical.
Yes,
wonderful
hour.
We totally appreciate your being here.
Oh, great. Well, listen, just if anybody wants more information, let's repeat the website again. So it's, www.lasko.net. And if you sign on, subscribe, and we'll send you information about when we're coming to the East Coast.
Wow, I'm excited. That'll be great.
That will be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, both of you. Thank you.
Good night.
Appreciate it. Thank you. I'll play this music again, and love to everybody in your sphere, Leonard, and love to you, Joan.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you.